From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Welcome to Worldviews. Two major centennial anniversaries took place this week. April 24th marks Genocide Remembrance Day to commemorate the massacre of millions of Armenians by the Ottoman Empire.
They have recognized it as much as a tragedy and have given their condolences, but will not recognize it as a genocide.
And Wednesday was the 100th anniversary of the first widespread use of chemical weapons on World War I's Western Front.
In the first 5 minutes of the first attack, we have 1,200 people that died.
Later, Rebecca Cruz talks with Asma Uddin. She started the online magazine Alt Muslima as a forum for issues of gender and Islam, but it resonated across many faiths.
She was getting married in a Catholic church and wanted a modest dress and couldn't find it anywhere, and she ended up with a Muslim seamstress.
These conversations are coming up after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat. Rebecca Cruz, a couple of important anniversaries, 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide this week. To refresh our memories, the Ottoman Turks were rounding up Armenian Christians due to concerns that they had with Armenians joining some alliance with Russia during the First World War. So what happens is about a million and a half people die at the hands of Turkey. Turkey's never really acknowledged or apologized, at least not officially. And others debate whether it was or was not a genocide, whether it was ethnic cleansing. I mean, there's lots of muddiness here with this issue. President Obama promised during his campaign to call it a genocide and criticized President Bush in his previous administration for not calling it that. But he still hasn't acknowledged it and called it a genocide. So why are we struggling here with this issue 100 years later of calling it what it is or something else?
Well, you're right. It's been very controversial. And Turkey has come from the position that genocide, as we've discussed, is very much a legal term. And they argue that this does not meet the legal definitions, although that is very contended. Just this past month, the European Parliament has voted to recognize it as a genocide. And Pope Francis also used the term. And most historians of genocide clarify that this is, in fact, a genocide. In fact, the gentleman that came up with the term genocide, a man named Raphael Lemkin, who had left Poland during World War II, came up with this term because he felt it brought together two words, a Greek word, genus, that had to do with family and tribe, race, and then side, which had to do with killing. So it was the killing of a race or the killing of a people. He had in mind, of course, the Holocaust, which he was witnessing, but he also specifically mentioned the Armenian genocide. So from the very construction of the word, the Armenian situation was in mind. But as I said, the Turks are saying that this is overblown, that the number of people involved was much smaller. They have recognized it as much as a tragedy and have given their condolences for the tragedy, but will not recognize it as a genocide. And, of course, the United States, as a partner to Turkey, has been very hesitant as well. The past president, President Bush, would not recognize the term. And as you said, Obama, though he promised to do so, has not done so yet either.
Well, clearly concerned about that strategic partnership, that friendship with Turkey, although it is strange. So I guess we'll see how this turns out. But it's important to the Armenians, clearly. They've made it clear that they need this. Well, let's move on to another anniversary for this week, another 100th anniversary of the first use of chemical weapons, also used during the First World War, killing about 100,000 people and injuring about a million. Of course, we saw many years later an attempt to ban these weapons, to establish a chemical weapons convention. There is a fairly strong chemical weapons taboo that exists around the world today, but not for everyone, obviously. Attempts to destroy chemical weapons is a slow process, and the concern is that they end up in the hands of those that really shouldn't have them, that wouldn't comply with this chemical weapons convention. So what are we to make of this, Rebecca?
Well, it's such a brutal weapon of war. We've seen the pictures from World War I. I think those images that we have of the trenches and the people with the gas masks dying really come from this image. And in the first 5 minutes of the first attack with chlorine in France, we have 1,200 people that died in such a quick period of time. And then it went back and forth. And obviously, as they were in the trenches, the gas kind of just sat there and really people they suffocated on their own lungs and their own breath. So just a brutal, brutal thing. And after World War I, you have the Geneva Protocols, which laid out a lot of kind of rules for war. One of them was a prohibition on gas. And as you said, this has become a part of a taboo, very much anti-use But we know that it has continued. Prior to World War II, the Italians are known to have used it in North Africa. We were familiar with it in the Iraq-Iran war. And then, of course, our involvement in the Middle East more recently with the Gulf War and the Iraqi war. Chemical weapons became a major concern. And we think that this is something that should be over. But we know that it has been used in Syria. And there are now some officials that are saying that ISIS has the capabilities to use these sorts of weapons and very easily could. So something we seriously, even 100 years later, after we've seen this devastation, something we are still very concerned about.
Well, I was going to ask about where the biggest hotspot, I guess, today for chemical weapons would be. And it seems that Syria is the case. And as you mentioned, you know, a non-state actor getting their hands on these kinds of weapons and not being prone to comply with such things as chemical weapons conventions and taboos. I mean, what are our options here?
We don't necessarily have a lot of options. Even when Syria, the government of Syria, it's confirmed that Syria used this, the United States came out and opposed it, but no action was taken. So when we're now talking about a non-state actor, it becomes even more difficult to try to control their usage. We can pressure them. We can continue to try to halt their movements, but there's very little that we can do at this point.
All right. Well, Rebecca, thank you as always for being here on Worldviews.
Thank you.
If you have any thoughts about this conversation, let us know by leaving your questions and comments in the Worldview section of our website. We also welcome your feedback on Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU, at Suzette Gorelot, and at Cruise226. You can also subscribe to our podcast and download this show from iTunes and read transcripts and in-depth recaps of all of our interviews at KGOU.org. Next, Rebecca talks with Asma Uddin, an attorney with the Beckett Fund, who also founded a new media venture focusing on gender issues in Islam. I'm Suzette Gorelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelot. Our guest today is Asma Uddin. She's an attorney with the Beckett Fund in Washington, D.C., where she focuses on religious liberty cases. Uddin also founded the website Alt Muslima. The senior religion editor at the Huffington Post called Alt Muslima an important platform for the intersection of gender, belief, and well-being for Muslims. She spoke with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
Asma Uddin, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
You are currently an international attorney focusing on religious justice. It's a very interesting idea, religious justice. Where did this come from? What was the path that you took that really led you to get a degree of this nature and to do the work that you're doing?
Well, I think in some ways I was led to this position without really having planned for it. I was always interested in religion. It was one of my majors, one of my three majors in undergrad.
Three majors.
And it actually became a major simply by virtue of my taking one too many classes in religious studies. Then I went to law school because I wish I had some grand plan, but actually I went to law school because I really didn't know what else to do. And there was a point at which I had decided that I needed to make a change and I needed to do something that I was truly going to be good at and that I would love. And so what did I think of? I thought about religion because it was something that was a common thread throughout my educational career. And my perspective on religion, despite, you know, all the experiences that I had that were complex and that gave me a fuller idea of the role that religion plays in people's lives, I ultimately always held the belief that religion was a positive force for individuals and for societies. And so I was looking for a place to work where they respected that role of religion in the public space. And my job search was made pretty easy by the fact that there's only one law firm in the entire country that defends religious liberty for people of all faiths and comes at it from the perspective of religion being a source of good.
Well, and this is a personal experience for you. As you explained, you grew up in this country as a Muslim in the United States, growing up in the last two decades or so when the idea and the image of Islam has perhaps been affected by certain events. 9/11, for example, comes to mind. What was it like growing up in this country as a Muslim American?
I think, you know, for you're right in saying that the 9/11 was probably like a turning point in the experience of American Muslims in this country. Before, you know, most people didn't really know about Muslims or Islam, or if they did, it was really just another religious group. And then when the spotlight was unfortunately put on us with 9/11, it became a much more complex existence. You know, unfortunately, many of my colleagues and myself included, in the community, in the American Muslim community, often feel like we spend so much of our time defending our faith or being spokespeople for our faith, and that really detracts from just being religious believers and being able to focus on the spiritual aspects. It's the nature of our world. It's the nature of just our current experience, and I have embraced so the activism that comes with it, the responsibilities that come with it.
Well, in the organization that you're now working for, there's been a number of cases where you have had the opportunity to be involved in protecting religious liberties. One of those that will resonate perhaps with many Oklahomans is the Hobby Lobby case. Can you maybe talk a little bit about your role in that very famous case?
Yeah, so Hobby Lobby is one of many cases that we are handling, dealing, and that we're still currently handling, dealing with the HHS mandate, which is a mandate that was part of Obamacare, part of the Affordable Care Act. And that essentially mandated that certain employers, not all employers, there were exceptions for certain types of employers to cover contraception for their employees free of cost. And in the Hobby Lobby case specifically, it wasn't all contraception that the employers were objected to covering. It was a limited number that they would characterize as abortifacients. But we have numerous clients, both Catholic and non-Catholic, who have really strong religious objections to having any role in the provision or facilitation of the use of these drugs. And we've defended those rights because ultimately, there's a sincere religious belief at the core of the government by imposing this duty. The failure to fulfill essentially leads to millions of dollars in fines. It's just a classic example of, something that's wrong under the religious freedom jurisprudence of this country.
That's Asma Uddin, an attorney with the Beckett Fund in Washington, D.C., who focuses on religious liberty issues. We'll hear more about her new media venture, Alt Muslima, right after this short break. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. This half hour, we're hearing from Asma Uddin, a lawyer for the Washington, D.C.-based Beckett Fund. The firm solely focuses on religious liberty cases. She's been speaking with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
Are there other cases that come to mind when you think about kind of these issues where there's, controversial decisions that are needing to be made that are perhaps getting attention or maybe not getting attention, ones that we maybe didn't hear so much about?
Unfortunately, religious liberty restrictions are happening every day. Many religious groups face them, some more than others, some at different levels. Certain groups, like in the case of these HHS mandate cases, a lot of it is really religious organizations facing it. But then you have scenarios, especially dealing with minority groups, whether it be Sikh Americans or Muslim Americans, who are dealing with them at the more individual level. But many of them, some of them you hear about them in the news. They get as much attention, for example, as one of our cases dealing with Islamic Center of Murfreesboro in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. There was an entire CNN documentary made about the conflict where local residents, some of the local residents, opposed the expansion of the Islamic Center and vandalized they engaged in vandalism and also burned down a lot of the construction materials. And then there was also a legal challenge arguing that the Islamic Center is not protected by some of our laws that protect religious land use, because the argument went that Muslims are not religious believers, Islam is not a religion, and therefore is not deserving of protection. And so cases like that, which was also handled by the Beckett Fund, have made obviously the headlines and, were an entire subject of a documentary. But then there's so many others, whether it be the ability of Sikh Americans to carry their symbolic kirpan, which is a small blunt knife, into a federal building, gets less attention. Numerous other land use cases that happen every day. There's so many of them, but they don't make the headlines. But there are religious organizations dealing with them every day. There are prisoners' rights cases where, you know, prisoners are seeking the right to have access to religious diets or religious material. And, you know, those cases are always ongoing. Again, some catch the headlines, but most recently our case at the U.S. Supreme Court involving a Muslim prisoner who was seeking to grow a 1/2-inch beard and who wasn't permitted to because the prison policy said that all prisoners had to be clean-shaven unless there was a medical need for it. And it seems like such a small issue. A lot of people think, why is the Supreme Court listening, you know, taking a case on about a half-inch beard? But it's not about a half-inch beard. It's about the broader principles at issue. The fact that there were laws passed by Congress, understanding that when prisoners, when you enter a prison, you don't give up your constitutional rights, you don't give up your fundamental human rights, your right to religious liberty. Religion plays a huge role in the rehabilitation of prisoners. And prison officials all too often are so easily just wave away those rights. And so there are protections put in place that required officials to produce the right evidence before they engage in these restrictions. And so, again, these sorts of cases happen all the time, and some of them get a lot of media attention and some of them don't.
Given that it seems so, well, in some ways common, it's somewhat surprising that there really is only the Beckett Fund that is dealing with these sorts of cases.
Well, there's definitely other groups. The ACLU has a Freedom of Religion program. The Americans United for Separation of Church and State has their own set of cases. And there's prisoner rights groups and so on. But what makes the Beckett Fund unique is that, our singular focus on religious freedom cases, the fact that we are a group of attorneys of diverse faith backgrounds working for clients of diverse faith backgrounds. And we take the uniform approach in all of our cases that religion is a positive and that we're going to protect it regardless of whether the adherent is adherent to a majority religion or a minority religion.
Well, this is very fascinating. You've also been doing some other very interesting work, which goes back to your position or your role as a Muslim American and also as a female Muslim. You have recently created a very, very interesting web magazine called Alt-M. And the goal of this web magazine is to discuss gender and Islam. It has a number of articles that are included that look at different issues that women might face, different sects or brands of Islam. Very, very fascinating. And I understand that you came to this decision to create this based on an experience in a book club. Can you talk maybe a little bit about that?
So even the book club came from somewhere. And it was really all of it's rooted in my experience growing up a Muslim female in America and everything that comes with. And as we were speaking about this earlier, just the complicated experience of American Muslims. And even pre-9/11, there were a lot of questions I had about my faith, just kind of being exposed from the moment. I mean, just from my travels to other countries, to Muslim-majority countries, but also seeing a lot of foreign students on my college campus and understanding over time that there are multiple Islams. It's interpreted and applied in just infinite number of ways. Someone has once said that the number of Islams are equal to the number of Muslims because each person approaches it and lives it differently. And just coming to that realization over time and also understanding that there were some interpretations and some Islams that I just couldn't accept. The internal struggle I went through to understand whether or not I was fully authentic Muslim, even as I was rejecting the other interpretations. And, you know, I came through that nuance and that internal dialogue and through a lot of spiritual reflection, but over time realized that there are a lot of Muslims who don't reach the same conclusion or who don't engage in the same level of analysis and ultimately are turned away from the faith or are left struggling and ultimately feel really lonely and isolated. And that's really where the website came from. So the book club was the first step along the way to kind of make this, take it from an individual to collective experience. And so the book club discussion group was my attempt at gathering people together to talk about relevant literature. And that was, it really cemented my belief in the fact that a need for this forum was needed.
And what are some of the issues that are discussed on the webpage? What are some of the issues that Muslim Americans or Muslims in general face, particularly gender issues?
Mm-hmm. So we do focus solely on gender issues, but we define that pretty broadly. And so you'll see a lot of storytelling and personal experiences that are part of it, but specifically because the story is being told by an American Muslim woman. That's really the gender angle there, because I think that those sort of identity-based, you know, negotiations that we have with ourselves and our community are very much part of the discussion. But in terms of the specific gender issues, I mean, they range from the international, looking at the specific women's rights struggles in particular countries to throughout the Arab Spring, for instance. We were looking at, you know, instances of sexual harassment that were happening, but also just like the role of women and how it was really a revolution that was, you know, undertaken by men and women together equally. It was, in fact, the entire Egyptian revolution was started by a Muslim woman. And so, you know, exploring the international parts and then domestically very specific intercommunity issues, such as the experience of women who have decided to take on the wearing the headscarf, or women who've worn it for many, many years and decided for various reasons to stop, and like, and what type of social backlash they dealt with. We've talked about, you know, courtship, relationship, sexuality in the Muslim context, which is actually the one area I think where our multi-faith sort of relevance began to emerge, as more and more women of other faiths started contacting us and telling us that that's, you know, so-and-so article talking about this relationship issue, you know, is something that we experience in our faith community, pretty much verbatim. And that's where the conversation started opening up. And, you know, we were getting emails from Jewish women, evangelical women, Catholic women. And one particular Catholic woman, really, you know, she wrote a piece for our site about, so the piece that really started the whole thing was really her quest to find a modest wedding dress. She was getting married in a Catholic church and wanted a modest dress and couldn't find it anywhere. And she ended up with a Muslim seamstress. And in the course of their conversations about shared values of modesty, she wrote a piece for us, which went viral. And ultimately, that same woman then started our sister site, Alt-C, which stands for Alt-Catholica. So it's a Catholic conversation on gender issues. And now we have launched an umbrella magazine called Alt-Femme that covers broader issues of feminism and faith.
What's so interesting that you have women of different Islams and then bringing in women of different faiths as well, and realizes that there are quite a few similarities, even if they are dealt with and felt perhaps differently. Well, very, very interesting topics that you're dealing with, and we'll continue to follow your research and your successes. Thank you so much for being here.
Great. Thank you.
You've been listening to Rebecca Cruz's conversation with Asma Uddin, an attorney with the Beckett Fund and the editor-in-chief of the online magazine Alt Muslima. You can find a link to that on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of KGOU with support from the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Sam Dupre prepares our digital content, Symphony Swift is our research fellow, and the show is produced by Brian Hardzinski. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Rolott.